Matthew 5, verse 6 says, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be satisfied." Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be satisfied. Now, as with all the other Beatitudes contained within Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, when we seek to understand what Jesus is meaning in these sayings, it's important that we don't separate Jesus' word from the context in which he's saying them. So when we hear Jesus speak about hungering and thirsting after righteousness, what does he mean? Well, righteousness in the Bible, it can mean moral righteousness, or it can mean social righteousness. Moral righteousness is all about how we relate to God, living our lives in such a way that pleases God, what we might call personal holiness. But social righteousness is about how we relate to those around us, about living our lives in relational connection with others in such a way that pleases God. And in this beatitude, Jesus is examining our spiritual appetite and our spiritual thirst for righteousness in both of these areas. Now, there is a danger that when us preachers are given a text to preach on that contains the words hunger and thirst for righteousness, that we immediately go and think of applying this beatitude to personal holiness and morality. Now, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. That's the main part of where my message is going this morning. Hashtag spoiler alert. But as we know from the nativity account of Jesus, his arrival, of Jesus' long promised Messiah, the context of the day was that the nation of Israel, the people of God, they were longing for a time when all wrongs towards them would be put right, especially in the areas of injustice and oppression, which in Jesus' day, and long before it, had been at the hands of the occupying Roman pagan powers. And many in Jesus' day were looking forward to when this promised Messiah would arrive and he would do away with all the unjust and oppressive practices that they faced. A time when this new king would arrive and establish a just and righteous throne. And it's in this context that those hearing Jesus' words in this beatitude would most likely have interpreted them as some form of social justice for the people of God. You know, yes, we hunger and thirst for God's promised Messiah to come and make all things right for us as the people of God. And as we are the people of God, 21 centuries on from the context in which Jesus gave these words, we also shouldn't fall into that same trap of just limiting Jesus' words here in this beatitude as a call to personal holiness. Because the truth is, it's both of these things. Jesus is declaring God's desire to see all things put right. For in one sense, that's what righteousness means. This is right being defined as something or someone conforming to God's standards and expectations, being right with God in these things. And it's in this beatitude where Jesus is saying all things, whether they be personal or social, should be rightly connected and related to God and to each other. Put simply, it's longing for God in all things, longing for the kingdom of God to be in all things. So it's social righteousness and it's moral righteousness. That's why next week we've got a successful, prominent Christian businessman called Paul Bulkley, who's behind a brilliant discipleship tool called BizMin. It's short for business ministry. And at the heart of Paul's ministry, it's about equipping people in business to see their business primarily as ministry. It's what is called kingdom business. And Paul's going to be explaining a little bit about that next week. Paul was at Winchester Baptist Church, which is where Cherie and I and the kids were before we came here. And they're very good friends of ours. And I know that Paul has a deep passion to see our Christian faith applied into every area of our lives, especially in the business arena. And Paul goes all over the country and all over the world, as well as doing his job, trying to kind of inspire people involved in business in this way. See, our Christian faith and living it out in right ways, it's not just something that's confined to these church walls on a Sunday or our midweek home group or Bible study group or prayer meetings. Not that there's anything wrong with these things, but it's about seeing God's desire for righteousness, rightness, all things conforming to God's standards and expectations for us as Christians, as being something that applies to every single area of our lives. So hopefully you'll be encouraged and inspired next week through what Paul brings. And this is where Jesus is coming from in this beatitude. We can't, as the people of Jesus' day did, just make hunger and thirsting for righteousness about something merely on a social level. Let's get rid of the Romans. What the Romans ever done for us? But neither can we have the approach that says, well, all that Jesus is concerned about is the condition of our hearts and our souls. The application of this beatitude just being about personal sanctification and holiness. Because the truth is, it's both of these things. So, now up to now, in the previous beatitudes we've been looking at, the emphasis has always been about passivity. But this one has an active emphasis. When we've been looking at those who are poor in spirit, those who mourn, those who are meek, Jesus has been describing what these people are. But in this beatitude, he shifts to describe what people do. Those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. So, spiritual hunger and thirst. I wonder if you can remember a time when you had a feeling of hunger. A time when you were really, really hungry. I don't know if you can remember that. If you remember what that feels like. It might be it's now. We've got some bread here. You might come and have a bit if you're a bit hungry. I remember a time when I was about 18 years old. It was one Saturday in the summer, and we'd planned with some of my church friends. We planned to go on a long bike ride in the Lake District, but my alarm didn't go off, and I overslept. So I was in a bit of a rush, and I didn't have time for breakfast. I didn't have time to make myself a packed lunch or anything like that, but I was okay. I was 18. I was young. I was fit. This wasn't going to be a problem. So we'd gone out on this bike ride for the day, right round kind of Morecambe Bay and the southern bit of the Lake District. It was an absolutely amazingly lovely, beautiful day, like today. But because I'd not eaten, and obviously doing this cycling, I'd used up lots of energy, because we have these things in the Lake District called hills. You may have heard of them. And I was feeling more and more hungry. My body was getting more and more depleted of energy. And I was increasingly feeling quite faint. But not that I'd let anybody know about this. You know, I was trying to impress the young ladies that were on the bike ride with me. So it got to a point just outside Carnforth, if you know the area particularly well. And I was feeling so bad. I was feeling dizzy. My vision started to go black around the peripheries. And I realized that this was not very good. So I decided what I'd do is I would kind of go on ahead of everybody else and try and get home quickly. But things only got a little bit worse. So I decided after a few miles that I would get off my bike and lie on the ground at the side of the road. And I don't know how long I'd been there, but all I can remember is kind of my friends standing over me trying to stuff sandwiches and chocolate down my throat. And I think the next thing that happened was I must have blacked out, because the next thing I do is I wake up and I realize that I'm lying in the back of a police van with my bike next to me. And I'm thinking, what have I done? What has happened? Now, apparently, the police had been passing the scene where I was lying on the ground with my friends shoving food down my throat. They thought I'd been knocked off my bike, so they stopped to check to see if I was okay. And when they realized what happened, they put me and my bike in the back of the police van, and they were taking me to Lancaster Royal Infirmary to get checked out. They noticed me kind of coming round in the back of the police van, looking a bit bemused at my situation. And they explained to me what had happened. But I assured them that I was okay. And it was only that I'd just not eaten all day. That was all. So if they could drop me off at the KFC, which was next to the police station, I would be okay. They were worried about my well-being and said that I really should go to the hospital and get checked out. But I said, no, just drop me at KFC. I'm going to be okay. Who needs medical attention? All that's required is a bargain bucket of greasy fried chicken and a vat of sugary drink. That would make me right as rain. So they eventually succumbed to my request, and they dropped me off at KFC. I ate half my bucket weight in Kentucky Fried Chicken, rested for an hour, and then cycled the other 45 minutes home absolutely fine. Now, that day, I learnt my lesson of the importance of paying attention to one's hunger. Before embarking on a long bike ride, make sure you eat a bucket load of KFC. In first century Palestine, when Jesus was writing, Jesus was sharing the words of this beatitude in the Sermon on the Mount, there were no handy KFCs nearby for police vans to drop off stranded cyclists outside when they got hungry. The average person working in Palestine would probably only eat meat once a week. Many of the hearers of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount and this beatitude, they lived close to the borderline between hunger and starvation. Water was an even more precious commodity. Unlike us today, who we just need to run one of the many taps that we have in our houses to get clean water, or if we're out and about, just visit one of the many available shops to buy one of the 100 or more varieties of water that are on offer. In Jesus' time, when he spoke these words, life had to be carefully planned around the availability of enough water to just stay alive, let alone quench your thirst. In our modern day Western culture and these conditions of hunger and thirst, they are difficult for us to fully appreciate, aren't they? Hunger and thirst, for some people in the world, are very, very, very powerful drivers. But I suspect it's something that many of us in Western affluent cultures don't fully appreciate. Many of us here never really experienced lasting hunger or thirst. The closest we probably get is maybe watching the plight of third world refugees on TV while tucking into a Chinese and a beer or a glass of wine. Or perhaps at some point in the past we've done a sponsored famine for 24 hours to raise money for charity. Or we willingly go without food for a short period of time because we need to lose some weight. Apart from that, we don't fully appreciate that desperate, desperate need for food or for water. When the Bible speaks about hunger and thirst, it means those raging pangs suffered by those who will actually starve to death if they do not eat, or if they will die if they do not drink. And as I say, while this context might be difficult for us to imagine, it's not difficult for us to understand. Food and drink are two of the most basic human needs for survival. So it's no wonder that Jesus uses this imagery to get his point across in this beatitude. But the point is even more powerfully expressed when you understand the structure of the words in its original language. Now don't worry, I'm not going to get all Greek on you this morning, but please do bear with me. This is really important in understanding this beatitude. You see, if you wanted to express the view that a person was hungry or thirsty, in Greek you would normally construct the sentence something along the lines of this. He is hungry for some bread, or she is thirsty for some water. That makes sense even in English, doesn't it? That's pretty straightforward. But the way Jesus constructs this sentence here in this beatitude is different to that way of expressing hunger and thirst. In the original Greek, it translates something more like, he is hungry for bread, or she is thirsty for water. Now, looking at those two examples, you might think, well, that's just saying the same thing, expressed in a slightly different way. What are you waffling on about, Tim? But the thing is, it isn't the same. Jesus is not expressing that someone should be hungry or thirsty for some righteousness, as in a limited experience of righteousness or a portion of righteousness. This is Jesus going into the spiritual fish and chip shop, and he's not asking for a portion of fish and chips. He's asking for every single fish the shop has and every chip that is available. Jesus is saying that this kind of hunger and thirst wants all righteousness that is possible to have. And so why is this important? Well, because this beatitude isn't just about us having good spiritual intentions. That's not what Jesus is saying. He isn't saying, well, try your best when it comes to the things of God. You know, have a go, see what happens. What will be, will be. That isn't what Jesus is saying. The language Jesus is using here is calling us to a passionate spiritual desire to be right with God in every area of our lives. To be fully committed to getting rid of those things, those actions, attitudes, words, values, basically sin. Getting rid of those things that get in the way of us being right with God. King David summed up this attitude and approach to in the words expressed in the Psalm, Psalm 42, verses 1 and 2. As the deer longs for streams of water, so I long for you, O God. I thirst for God, the living God. Where can I go and stand before him? And then in Psalm 63, David says, you, God, are my God. I earnestly seek you. I thirst for you. My whole being longs for you in a dry and parched land where there is water. See, these aren't just twee, trite little spiritual phrases, and neither are they expressing spiritual feelings superficially. They're wholehearted, earnest, urgent, passionate cries from the depths of someone for whom life without the presence of God, being right with God, is, you know, the spiritual equivalent of starvation to death. And the question is, I wonder when the last time was that you and I felt like that. What do we hunger and thirst for? Well, I guess some of us might hunger and thirst to partake in binge watching when we hunger for that next episode of the TV program that we've been watching. Remember the infuriation of the olden days when you had to wait a whole eternity of 7 days for the next episode to be shown on TV? Praise the Lord for Netflix and iPlayer and other streaming services that satisfy our, that instantly satisfy our TV hunger and thirst. Or maybe for others it might be that hunger and thirst for the next reel on Facebook or Instagram. You know, just one more kind of clip, one more video. And before you know it, an hour or 2 hours has passed. Perhaps there might be some here who hunger and thirst for maybe that new job or a promotion or better pay and conditions. If I could just get that, if I just had this, then I would be blessed. Then I would be fully satisfied. The same might be true for that new car or expensive designer outfit or that expensive gadget or piece of jewelry or the amazing holiday destination, whatever it might be. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with these things. There isn't. But I would argue that their ability to satisfy are only short-lived. You know, you go on that amazing holiday, and if you're anything like me, the day you get back, you're already looking and planning for the next holiday. Or you know, you get that new job or promotion, but there's always somebody, isn't there, who's got a better job, who's on more money than you are. There's always someone who's got a better car or a bigger house than you do. And the notion that if I just had this or if I just got that, then I would be satisfied and fulfilled. It's a fallacy. It's that consumerist lie that feeds into our hunger and thirst for more stuff. That even when we get, doesn't satisfy us for very long. And I don't think there's anything wrong with hungering and thirsting. It's just that most of the time we are feeding and drinking on the kind of things that are never really going to satisfy us. That don't really have the eternal value beyond this life. This side of heaven, we will always be hungering and thirsting for something. But this beatitude of Jesus is telling us that what we hunger and thirst for really, really matters. Later on in his Sermon on the Mount, Jesus really presses home this need for a priority change when he gives us this instruction in Matthew 6:33. Jesus says, seek first God's kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. This promise of Jesus here has both an immediate and a future meaning. It's Jesus explaining how what we do or we don't do now in this life has implications for us in eternity. It's the promise of how things will be if we seek to bring all things in our lives right with God. And this beatitude we're looking at today realigns our hunger from the things of this world to the things of the kingdom. Things from temporal to the eternal. It's that realignment that's at the heart of the gospel of salvation. It's losing our lives in order to find a new life, our true lives in and with Jesus. This is Jesus saying that we will only really find true satisfaction and fulfillment in seeking first God's kingdom and his righteousness. We will only find satisfaction and fulfillment when we hunger and thirst for the things of God in every area of our lives. Personal righteousness, you know, holiness, but also social righteousness, how we relate to those around us, the people that we engage with. And the thing is, though, I do wonder if sometimes, as affluent Western Christians, our lives are a little bit like modern motor vehicles. How many of you have ever been on that stress, in that stressful situation when you're driving along in your car, blissfully happy, enjoying the journey, for you have no small children who've been asking you for 700th time if they're nearly there yet, or screaming that they need a wee just 2 miles after leaving the service station where they went for their previous wee. But then you're driving along, and then all of a sudden, the little orange or red light comes on the car. Okay. There you go. The little red or orange light comes on the car and warning you that fuel is low and it needs refilling. You've been in that situation? Now, I've heard there are some men out there, I can't imagine who they might be, some of these elusive men that when they see the near empty light or gauge on their cars, they take it as a personal challenge. Your wife says to you, we're nearly empty, it's imperative that we stop and take on more fuel at the next petrol station. To which some of these men scoff, no, we're not nearly empty. We've got at least another 50 miles in the tank. Plenty of fuel to get to our destination. Away with your concerns, my dear. Is this sounding familiar to anybody here? I don't know. Now, I've heard that many times these individuals who say things like this are correct, but occasionally, very occasionally, they are not. And the dreaded thing happens. The car eventually runs out of fuel and it grinds to a halt, which will be quite dangerous if you're stuck on the hard shoulder of a motorway, or even worse, if you run out of fuel in the fast lane of the motorway and you have to coast your way over three lanes of busy traffic to the safety of the hard shoulder. Now, I don't know if this is sounding familiar. Anybody ever been in that situation of running out of fuel? Oh, Barry has, or Michael, oh, dear. We'll have a special prayer ministry for you or your wives later on at the end of the service. Now, I wonder if there aren't many Christians who kind of live their lives in that kind of way. You know, outwardly, everything seems to be okay. Everything's kind of going along swimmingly. They live seemingly spiritual lives. They attend church regularly. They give towards the ministries of the church. They use all the right spiritual words. But inwardly and spiritually, they are very nearly empty. They've been ignoring the spiritual orange or red light of their souls for years. In other words, there's no sense of need. No spiritual hungering or thirsting after the deep things of God. No desire to be right with God in every area of their lives. And you know what is even worse than having no desire or passion for those things, don't you? Even worse is not even being aware that you are on empty. It's spiritually empty Christians that God spoke to in the church of Laodicea in the book of Revelation when he said to them, you say, I am rich. I have everything I want. I don't need a thing. And you don't realize that you are wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. This is God saying to us that being spiritually empty with no passion or deep desire to be right with God in every aspect of our lives. It's like walking around being naked and blind. Not the kind of thing I suspect many of us would want to do. I do wonder if God made it so that when we as Christians entered through the doors of a church on a Sunday, that we suddenly became dressed in the amount of clothes commensurate with our spiritual health. I just wonder how empty our churches would be. Now you'll be pleased to know I'm not going to linger on that image for very long. Because the promise of God in this beatitude is that although spiritual health, our spiritual health may not be what it should be, may not be what God expects, God doesn't leave us in the state of being spiritually wretched, miserable and poor. God offers us the remedy. He offers us spiritual fulfillment and spiritual satisfaction. For they will be satisfied. They will be filled. As with all the other Beatitudes, this one comes with a promise. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be satisfied. And the New Testament word used here, fulfilled or satisfied, is chortezo. Now, I know it sounds a little bit like a spicy Italian sausage, but it's not. Chortezo is like a big, fat, extravagant word that reflects the fullness of Christ's promise to those who hunger after the things of God. It actually means more than just being filled or satisfied. Chortezo means to gorge yourself. Now, I don't know about you, but I can't remember the last time I did any serious gorging. I might come close to it when I'm looking at the Chinese menu, and Cherie says, do you fancy a Chinese takeaway for dinner tonight? But, you know, Jesus here, the words he's using means to be filled to overflowing, more than satisfied, more than filled. It's Jesus' invitation to everyone who desires spiritual satisfaction and fulfillment. The same promise of God was given through the prophet Isaiah in the Old Testament when he says, come, all you who are thirsty, come to the waters, and you who have no money, come, buy and eat. Come, buy wine and milk without money and without cost. Why spend money on what is not bread and your labor on what does not satisfy? Listen to me. And eat what is good, and you will delight in the richest of fare. Give ear and come to me. Listen, so that you may live. The same invitation comes from God in the book of Revelation, where we hear, where am I at? Is that going on here? Am I pressing the right buttons? There you go. Where I hear, so I advise you to buy gold from me, gold that has been purified by fire. Then you will be rich. Also buy white garments from me, so that you will not be shamed by your nakedness. An ointment for your eyes, so that you will be able to see. I correct and discipline everyone I love. So be diligent and turn from your indifference. And again in Revelation, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give water without cost from the spring of the water of life. Now, I want you to imagine for a moment that you were starving to death. You were about to die of severe dehydration. And then somebody offered you something to drink and to eat. I very much doubt if you were genuinely in that kind of situation and somebody was offering you something to drink and you had this huge jug of water and you filled up a little kind of bottle top like that and you took that little bit of water that was there and then you said, oh, that's hit the spot. Now, thank you very much. So that's enough as I need. Or if you were starving to death and somebody offered you a huge loaf of bread here like this, you wouldn't kind of just pick off the tiniest crumb and eat it and say, oh, that's me finished. I couldn't manage another thing. You just wouldn't do that, would you? If you were starving hungry or thirsty to the point of dehydration, to the point of death, you would be kind of drinking the whole of that jug of water down. You're devouring and gorging every single crumb of that loaf of bread. We'd feast ourselves. And this is what Jesus is calling us to do in this beatitude. This is what God is inviting us to do. He does time and time again in Scripture. As those who are without money, to come to him, to have food and water for free. As those who are spiritually naked, to come to him to be clothed in those pure white garments. Or those who are spiritually blind, to come and get ointment that heals our eyes so that we're able to see. There's a great quote that I often use when I'm speaking about hope from this book called The Godly Man's Picture by Thomas Watson. He was a 17th century preacher who was educated at Emmanuel College, Cambridge. And he said in this book, one of the best books I've ever written, I think I've ever written on personal holiness. He said, if a friend invites guests to his table, he does not expect them to bring money for their meal. The only thing he requests they bring is an appetite. The only thing he requests they bring is an appetite. God's promise to the Old Testament Jeremiah was true for the people of God then, and it's true for every single person here in this room, every single person alive on the planet at the moment, and it's this. He says, you will seek me and find me. When you seek me with all your heart, then I will be found by you. And this promise here has nothing for those who are just looking to do life with a little bit of Christian spirituality on the side. You know, only when it's convenient for them. If this is how we live our lives as Christians, then no wonder we see such little evidence of the power of God at work in our lives. It's like that old saying, if God seems far away, guess who moved? Seeking God with all our heart means having that spiritual hunger, that spiritual thirst to be right with Him in every area of our lives. The longing for holiness is not intended to be a spiritual extra just for those really super spiritual Christians, you know, for ministers or those on the leadership team or those missionaries that go off around the world. Hungering and thirsting to be right with God in every area of our lives should be the passionate pursuit of every single person who calls themselves a Christian. In a moment, we're going to sing our final song, and I'm going to invite the worship team to come up now. The words of this song echo the command of Jesus to seek first God's kingdom and God's righteousness. The promise of which is that in doing so, we will gain something infinitely more of more value and worth than anything we had to give up to fully pursue the things of God, to be right with God in every area of our lives. The promise that when we seek God with all our hearts, we will find Him.